Hello, welcome to In the Kitchen with Brett Thorne, part of the Last Bite Network, a production of Nation's Restaurant News and Restaurant Hospitality. I'm your host, Senior Food and Beverage Editor, Brett Thorne. Happy New Year! That is apparently a controversial greeting this year. For the record, the polite response to Happy New Year is Happy New Year, or if you're feeling chatty, thank you, Happy New Year to you too. But these days I'm getting more cynical responses like, is it a Happy New Year? Well, to start with, Happy New Year isn't a declarative sentence. You're not saying, it is a Happy New Year. It's the bestowal of good wishes. It's short for, I hope you have a Happy New Year. And secondly, I'm about as jaded as a person can be, but why not be hopeful for a happy year? Given how the 2020s have been so far, chances are actually quite good that 2022 will be the best year in the decade yet. Here in New York, cases of the Omicron variant are trending downward, and the rest of the country is likely to follow suit soon enough. We have a new mayor who, well, okay, in the first week or so into his job, he called restaurant workers unskilled, and then he appointed his brother to be the head of his security detail, so that's not a great start, but hey, politician's gonna politician. And we all know that restaurant workers are skilled, and they're getting increasingly good at adapting to changing circumstances. Meanwhile, restaurants are starting to get busy again, and there are all sorts of exciting new concepts opening. And one of them is being spearheaded by my guest this week, the legendary chef and restaurateur Alexander Smalls. Smalls was the first chef in New York City to serve soul food in a fine dining setting, and then, several decades later, he explored the interplay between African and Asian cuisines at the Cecil in Harlem. Now he's working on Al Kebulan, an African food hall that already is up and running in Dubai, and Smalls is working on opening them in London and New York City too. We discussed that, as well as the largely glossed over role that the cuisines of Africa have had on global cuisines, his early career as an opera singer, and many other fascinating topics. And now, here is Alexander Smalls. And I am so glad to finally meet you, Alexander Smalls. I'm a little embarrassed we've never met before because you are legendary. You were the chef of the Cecil and Mittens, and now you are an author of cookbooks and all sorts of stuff. And you are opening an African food hall. Is called Al Kebulan. Did I pronounce that right?
Al Kebulan.
Al Kebulan.
Yes, the accent's on the key.
Al Kebulan. And there's already one in Dubai, but you're opening one here in New York City, in Harlem, and in London, right?
That's right. Those are our plans going forward.
Well, tell me all about it, or as much as you want.
What should I tell you all about? What Al Kebulan is?
What Al Kebulan, the word, it's an old ancient word for Africa, right?
Yes. It was the first. It was the first written Arabic word for Africa. And then the Europeans showed up and named it Africa.
Which is an almost impossibly broad term when we're talking about the very many cultures and foods and stuff of Africa. I was talking to a South African friend who had never heard of fufu, and I thought, huh, interesting.
So you just proved why this is so important. You know, essentially, most people are still walking around thinking Africa is a country and not a continent, and quite a huge continent with, many, many countries, many, many cultures, and diversity in all parts of it. So it was very important for me to really get engaged, involved in expanding the narrative and really telling Africa's story through the lens of its food, its culture, its art, because Al Kebulan is a complete experience for the senses. I mean, not only do we feed you the most extraordinary food and drink, but then we treat you to original African art, extraordinary African music, you know, and we managed to throw in a little cultural fashion. So you are immersed in an environment, one most people have no idea about.
Right. I would think including most Black Americans who might have a knowledge of their own family history, but not of the vast array that the country
has. Well, we all know that's by design. And so, right. Which is part of what we're doing, is undoing the damage of institutional racism, you know, and also the kind of prejudice that anything African is less than or not worthy. So, I mean, I had to confront this as a young Black boy growing up in the South, you know, choosing a profession that nobody my parents had ever seen did. You know, I wanted to be an opera singer. If you can imagine, my poor parents, when I give them so much credit, their greatest gift to me was never saying no, but the hell I put them through. They were training me to be a doctor, a lawyer, you know, respectable. They were the generation that education was going to change the trajectory, change the plight of Black folks, African Americans. And, you know, they did everything, whether it was two or three jobs, to make sure that my sisters and I were going to have every benefit of a solid education so we could be successful. And I come home and is exclaiming that I'm going to be an opera singer. And they just were perplexed. It wasn't part of the plan. And they literally had to just fasten their seatbelts. I took them places they never imagined going, in my innocence, but also in my passion. But I tell you that story because this is really how all of this began. You know, a child who was curious about the world always chose the most challenging, most difficult, seemingly impossible roads to follow. And, you know, when I essentially decided that, you know, I hit the glass ceiling in classical music, I wasn't going to be able to be everything I had dreamed to be, even with a Grammy and a Tony and lots of fancy friends. I wasn't able to arrive in that successful place. But what I learned is, in order for me to be successful, I not only had to own a seat at the table, I had to own the table. And I couldn't own an opera house, but my second love was food and hospitality. And so I set out to open the first fine dining African-American kitchen in New York City in the early 90s. And this is how it all starts, really.
And which restaurant was that in the early 90s?
Cafe Beulah. Cafe Beulah was on 19th and Park Avenue South. You know, I researched this thing. I understood that my success had to not look like anything else, that pathway that Black-owned restaurants took. So I went to the most expensive part of town, right off Park Avenue South, and I immersed myself in an up-and-coming area. Danny Meyer was there, Doug Rodriguez, all of these people heading up this new culinary conversation in the late 80s, early 90s. And this is where I found myself, no real formal training, you know, but I had quite the reputation as a host and cook, entertainer throughout the city, entertaining lots of celebrities, and a love and a passion that I knew that what I had to do was create African-American food in a way the world had not seen it.
So how did you do that? What was some of the food that you served?
Well, essentially, in my education and travels as an opera singer, living all over the world, traveling all over the world, I recognized that the African-American culinary conversation was not part of the conversation. People didn't even think of our food as a cuisine. It was soul food. It was heart attack food. It was castaway food. It was sneaky, indulgent food, but it wasn't respected. And I understood that fine dining was really about somebody's grandmother's or mother's cooking that had been redressed, replated, put into a classical landscape, and lots of beautiful china and flowers and things like that, that essentially carried a more of a curated museum kind of modern feeling. And so that's what I did. I took family recipes and also sort of my creative takes on traditional recipes, and I dressed them up and I put them on a beautiful plate and served and paired them with a glass of wine. And there we go. This is what we did.
It worked.
It worked. Five restaurants later, and now the Dubai project, it worked. And it also essentially gave me something that, well, it pronounced something in me that was there, but not truly focused. And that was the commitment to expand, elevate the narrative of food of the African diaspora, who we were. Because essentially my first three restaurants were about African-American food. I took a 10-year hiatus and I found myself wanting to connect the dots between African-Americans and Africa, which sent me on an odyssey all over the world, traveling, following the transatlantic slave trade, but also the trade in the East. There were slaves, African slaves in China that date back to the 1500s. Essentially on five continents, slavery from Africa was big business. This gave me a roadmap to not only understand Africa's influence in, and dominance in world culinary, but also to create a culinary discipline that mirrored what that would be if it were a language. Because of that, the Cecil, my last restaurant in Harlem, which I left in 2017, but the Cecil became my first Afro-Asian American concept, which garnered the Best New Restaurant in America, Esquire magazine. And the recipes became the volume of the Between Harlem and Heaven cookbook that won the James Beard Award that I did with J.J. Johnson.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting that you said that African-American food wasn't part of the American conversation. And although it wasn't included in the conversation, of course, as you know, it was part of it. It's the influencer of a lot of Cajun Creole cooking, low country cooking.
It's the foundation.
Right.
No, what I meant was it wasn't an oral conversation.
Right. Yeah, I understand.
It wasn't a part of the lexicon that consciously we recognize, but it was hard to talk about Africa when we were embarrassed by our own food, when we had been taught that our food was not on par, that it was, again, a sneaky, you know, sort of undercover indulgence. And so we had to garner first and foremost the respect for our own cuisine. And then, which sent me on my odyssey to Africa, to South America, to China, to understand exactly how African influence was dominant in most every cuisine's foundation, not just African-American.
Right. I mean, it's a huge part of Peruvian cuisine. And apart from Ethiopian cuisine, which I had in the U.S. in the 1980s, growing up in Colorado, where there was a small Ethiopian community, I had African food when I was traveling and living in Southeast Asia. I first had Zambian food at a guest house in Singapore, where there's some Zambian tourists who just shared their soup. That's the first time I had fufu. I had an Ivoirian friend in Bangkok who was like, oh, ginger, chilies, coconut. Huh, that looks familiar. And, you know, she would cook for me. You know, it was all part of the conversation.
Yeah.
And it was just great to see that food, you know, outside of the American context and so delicious. You know,
amazing. you know, the stereotype of what African food is for most people, when they realize what it truly is, they're going to be heartbroken that it took so long. I suggest everyone run to Al Kabul and run to Dubai as soon as possible.
So when is Al Kabul on Harlem opening, and what are some of the culinary highlights going to be?
Well, to think of culinary highlights, you simply have to look towards the Al Kabul for Expo in Dubai. But I will say that we are busy securing a location. You can imagine what that's like. I'd start to say post-pandemic, but I'm not sure we are post anything yet.
Right.
Interesting thing about Al Kabul is the original was called Harlem Food Hall, which I was looking for a space prior to the pandemic to open in Harlem. And pandemic came, my last book also came out at the same time. Everything stopped, my tour stopped. There was no looking for a restaurant space anymore. That was the last thing anybody wanted to do. And that's when Dubai called and said, we need you here. So interestingly enough, the roots of the food hall are already sort of distributed in the Harlem community. I mean, Harlem is the Mecca city for me when it comes to the African diaspora. It's also where I've made my home since 1998, when I came to Harlem, and it is the community that feeds me and inspires me. And being able to bring something like Al Kabul to this community, nothing excites me more than that. We are going to have, you know, I would say on average 20,000 square feet of food, of African food and beverage and celebration and art and music, you know, just nonstop. It's going to be a whole environment of regional African food from south to north, east to west. And we're going to bring in the music and the art that complements all of that, and hopefully be a destination not only for New Yorkers, but, you know, the many, many tourists and folks who find themselves coming to New York from all over the world looking for a unique experience.
Well, it sounds like they'll be having one. Are there particular dishes or ingredients or cuisines that you're particularly excited about bringing to Harlem?
Well, you know, you'll get me in trouble with that question.
It's like picking your favorite child.
Well, exactly. But let me say this: you know, African food is so extremely flavorful, colorful, aromatic. You know, you don't just eat with your taste buds. It's all the senses that are enacted because the smells are really, really brilliant. There are regions in Africa that are more known for their culinary expertise and brilliance. And those are the ones we hope to capture. And then we do something called street food, which allows us to under that umbrella, bring in, you know, Nigerian, Ghanaian, Senegalese street food, South African street food. So, because you can imagine with as many countries and regions that there are in Africa, to try to get everybody under the tent would be impossible. But what we want to do is give you an immersive experience. So we find ways to serve that experience up in many varied ways, again, such as the street food concept that allows us to bring in things from everywhere. But then we focus on, for example, you know, the South African barbecue, Bray, which is so popular. We focus in on the East African seafood, and fish market and the East African goat market. We have a whole restaurant dedicated to goat, which for, you know, Westerners, that's kind of odd, but not for the communities of the diaspora. Goat is a very popular dish. And so there'll be you know, lots of rice, because the African, like the Chinese culture, rice is foundational. And there are so many different varietals of rice, and so many different ways of making rice. You know, the whole debate that has gone on between Nigeria and Ghana about who makes the best jollof rice. And then the Senegalese, who claim to invent it, just ride in and say, this is not a contest.
We win. Be quiet.
We win. You know, but all of that is going to be there for you. And then the one in New York will focus more on the transatlantic experience than the one in Dubai. Each of these are really going to be created to mimic the history of its location. So the one in Dubai, I created two concepts that speak to the transatlantic to kind of open the bridge of something new. So when we get to Harlem, it'll be more transatlantic than continent Africa, but there's nothing you will miss. The idea is basically to have each Al-Kabulan be culturally reflective of the history. For example, when we do the London one, a lot of the British colonizations, both in Africa and the Caribbean, will have a front seat. So it's going to be like that. In Paris, it would be the French colonization. So this is how we're looking at making these all happen around the world.
So in the United States, that involves sort of a conversation about the West African influence brought over via the slave trade.
Absolutely. You know, you have conversations like New Orleans versus Charleston, Savannah, the Gullah country. And then you have, you know, the Black barbecue of Texas versus North Carolina well, South Carolina is the only one that has the most sauces. Like, South Carolina invented the mustard barbecue sauce. So you have that conversation. So we're going to play with it as much as possible within the context of trying to serve up, you know, a generous variety of who we are culturally and the history that particular land, you know, defines.
I can't wait for it to open. That sounds like so much fun. About how many different kind of food stalls or whatever you call them are there going to be at Al-Kabulan?
Well, somewhere between 10 and 12, 20,000 square feet will support that kind of engagement, and then we have a couple of bars. The Al-Kabulan in Dubai has an incredible East African bar with amazing crafted cocktails, and a South African that does exactly the same: crafted cocktails, serving up flavorful African inspired cocktails and bringing together a kind of exotic experience for the connoisseur who likes great cocktails. So we'll have that as well. So I'm excited, you know, and I'm hoping that we will be able to have a catering component to the Al-Kabulan here in Harlem. So it can be multifunctional, and I'll want to be able to do parties and events, you know, the possibility of renting the entire dining hall for an occasion would be something I would jump to trying to make happen. So I'm going to try to have auxiliary space for that, as well as for performing and entertainment, and it's going to be a party.
That sounds great. I'd be sad if there weren't a space for live performances, for song and dance. And
well, it's so much who we are. And right. and you know, and you never know when a parade may come marching through the hall while you're there entertaining, you know, whether that's the New Orleans band, you know, or a tribal ensemble with dances and drums. I mean, we want to be able to immerse you in a real emotional experience. So we look for all of that.
That sounds awesome. We're running out of time, but I wanted to plug your book that came out in 2020, which is called Meals, Music, and Muses, Recipes from My African-American Kitchen. Did I get that right?
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you.
And you have a children's book coming out. Is that right?
I do in 2023, next year. Very, very excited about that. Advanced details, except it really speaks to my childhood and my interests, which have always been food and music. So I'm hoping that it'll be entertaining and also reaffirming to young people that, you know, that inner voice that tells you who you are should be listened to and allowed to grow. The greatest gift my parents ever gave me, they never said no, even when they didn't understand it. They fed my curiosity and my talents and somehow allowed me to think, oh, that was normal.
Said, go get it. Be an opera singer. That's wonderful.
Exactly. And then they go in the room and cry.
Yes. Right behind closed doors.
Yes.
Well, Alexander Smalls, it was such a pleasure to meet you. I hope this is one conversation of many that we'll have in the years
Thank
to come
you.
as things progress. And congratulations in advance on an amazing food hall.
Appreciate it. Wonderful talking to you. And thank you so much for supporting the efforts and helping me get the news out.
I'm very excited.
<They're coming. laughs>